from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, we're going to talk about health and healing and the issues that are important to you. I'll be going to your calls, as I do each week when we set aside one program where there is no guest. There's no in-depth investigative report. I'm not going to be doing a commentary, nor will we be doing issues. Rather, it's mainly about health and nutrition. There'll be some discussion of issues that I feel are important to at least focus a little bit of attention on. I'm going to do a little more in-depth discussion today of a nutrient that I believe that we should be having that could improve the quality of our aging process, and it's called pycnogenol, P-Y-C-N-O-G-E-N-O-L, pycnogenol. And there's some new information from Janet Sardo, and I'll share that with you. Also, I'm asked about indole-3-carbinol, or I-3-C, because there's been a lot of research showing how it helps people, especially African Americans, in protecting the immune system and helping diminish the chances of prostate cancer. Well, not only prostate cancer, other cancers as well, so I'll talk a bit about that. And how do we get more gray matter, better gray matter? How do we become more cognitive, improving memory and alertness as we age? I'll give you a protocol for that as well. So let us begin. First, we know that when we look in the mirror, especially over a period of time, we're going to see some wrinkles or loss of the skin elasticity. And also, we don't have the same capacity to create collagen. And those are the first signs of aging. And you start to see a thinning of the skin, wrinkles, sagging, a jowiness. And then you start seeing it on your neck as well, then on your hands. The hands are easy because the skin thins. Now, it doesn't have to, but it does. And all this is based upon a degradation of our internal aging process. I've mentioned many times it's a process called glycation. And glycation is easy to understand. I've used this example to really highlight it. But because we have a lot of new people every day, in fact, we have about 50,000 new people per week tuning on. And these are generally people who are getting into not necessarily health and nutrition as much as on social issues. That's what we found. But we're happy to have them on board and help them slow down their aging process, too, though most are in their mid-30s. But by the way, we actually start to age at about 27. So just imagine that you have a chicken. It's plump and moist. You put it in the oven. You turn it on 350 degrees, and a half hour later, hour later, it's crisp. It's brown. What happened was that the heat changed the chemicals, the proteins, in the chicken and crisped it. Now, that is called glycation, and that's exactly what happens inside your body. The sun will do it. Alcohol does it. Hot dogs, hamburgers, french fries, sugar, artificial sweeteners, coffee will do it. All of these different things that we take in that we assume are okay, all of that causes premature aging. But your skin is one of your very first organs, and it's the largest organ in the body, to show that. In effect, what we do causes oxidative stress, inflammation, and damage to our DNA, and then the cell membranes get damaged, our arteries get damaged, the epithelial get damaged, and then our arteries can't carry blood the same way. And then the glycation speeds up the aging of the actual cell. That leads me to this pycnogenol. Now, pycnogenol comes from the French maritime pine tree, and what we know now about it, it's really important. It is a superstar. The phytomolecules actually help rejuvenate the skin elasticity and reduces collagen degradation. So if you take pycnogenol and you take vitamin C in buffered form in higher doses throughout the day, and you take quercetin with vitamin C, the two together, quercetin and vitamin C, help rejuvenate new collagen, and along with the pycnogenol. Now, so that means you're going to have younger skin. And even if you've had some sun damage, you can help reverse a lot of that. But it does more than that. It also helps to lower your glucose level. Therefore, I suggest it to the 90 million Americans who suffer from diabetes and pre-diabetes. And it also increases nitric oxide to dilate blood vessels. That means for men, that's a natural erection enhancer. So that's why you would take, let's say, a Viagra, but you don't need to do that. Now you can take this along with some L-arginine. Then it can help normalize your blood pressure. So think of the 60 million Americans who have post-stable hypertension and those who don't even know they have high blood pressure, so that could help save lives. So all that's important. It's a simple plant, and in it you have a widespread group of bioflavonoids, proanthocyanins, and these are all a part of helping us to slow down the aging process. So here's what we should know. I'll just summarize this. These are the takeaway things. As we age, everything that we did earlier in our life, we now pay for. And it's confusing, and I understand that, because you can say, well, Gary, I stopped drinking, social drinking, or binge drinking, or drinking too much, when I got out of college. And I haven't had a drink in 20 years. So what do you mean I have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease? And why do I have? And the answer is because when you did drink, the damage that was created is cumulative. When you smoked, it's cumulative. When you ate the hot dogs, hamburgers, and you drank the coffee, it's cumulative. So everything finally tips. So by the time you end up with fatigue, by the time you end up having a high blood pressure and you don't know why, that's not from that day. In fact, you may have been living a healthy life for the last 2 or 3 or 5 years. It's from earlier. To do the right thing, which is to undo a lifetime of abuse, you have to have a different model to work from. I won't discuss that today, but on an upcoming program I certainly will, because I just wrapped a major television special that will be coming out in the fall with a new book on how we can reverse the aging process with state-of-the-art stuff. But I'm simply explaining now that one way we can get started is by getting rid of the things that cause our cells to prematurely age, and then start to enhance our nutrition. And pycnogenol's one way we can do it. So I'm definitely big on that. And it's going to protect you from premature aging. Okay, and it will certainly help your heart and your arteries. And that is a big killer. That's number one killer in the United States. I'm going to suggest 200 milligrams twice a day. All right? So, and if, let me just give you a couple more examples. For me to help people turn off inflammation after I get them to stop certain things, then I look at the fact that chronic inflammation damages everything. I mean everything, from your eyes to your brain, to heart, to muscles. And what ends up happening is then you end up with atherosclerosis or osteoporosis or kidney disease or cancer. Well, pycnogenol and vitamin C both fight inflammation by switching off a central inflammatory generating system and reducing the production of inflammatory cytokine molecules. And as far as glycation, that's when the fats and proteins become glycated, when sugar molecules bond to them. And then you end up with cancer or Alzheimer's or arthritis. Well, pycnogenol prevents glycation by lowering the blood sugar level and preventing blood absorption into the intestine. And as far as oxidative stress, even running, and as I did this morning in the park with our Natural Living Running and Walking Club, had a great workout around Central Park. It's good to do this. We need to do this, but we also have to realize we're creating oxidative stress every time we breathe. And that actually causes a burn inside the tissue. That damages your DNA and the cell membranes. And then you end up with, later in life, even though you might have exercised, you end up with diseases. So to reduce that, you take your antioxidants. That traps the free radicals. That's good. And with pycnogenol, that boosts cells' natural antioxidant system, and it prevents the development of oxidative-related disease. And it's very important for helping people with diabetes. So that's our nutrient of the day. Now, there's something also important, and that is gray matter. Now, there's a new study from Science Daily, and it says, and I'll quote it, it says this: the volume of a small brain region influences one's predisposition for altruistic behavior. Researchers from the University of Zurich show that people who behave more altruistically than others have more gray matter at the junction between the parietal and temporal lobe, thus showing for the first time that there is a connection between brain anatomy, brain activity, and altruistic behavior. So that does not mean that we shouldn't be responsible for our selfishness, because that's conditional. But it shows that we have a capacity there in the brain. Now, how do we actually increase and enhance our gray brain matter? It's simple. First and foremost, look at the alpha-glycerol phosphorylcholine, about 500 milligrams, or phosphatidylserine at about 100 to 200 milligrams, and pregnenolone at 50 milligrams, and vinpocetin at 20 milligrams, and then grapeseed extract at about 100 milligrams, and wild blueberry extract about 100 milligrams, and ashwagandha extract at about 200 milligrams, and uridine 5 monophosphate at about 50 milligrams. Those are all important. Why? Simple. And that's part of a formula that I put together, not in a given product, but separately for people suffering from Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and ALS and cognitive decline and lack of cognition and memory loss. Let me just give you an example. The uridine, U-R-I-D-I-N-E, 5-monophosphate, is a phosphatide building block of RNA and DNA that is critical to optimal brain function and the health of your cells, your brain cells, neurons. And it's essential not only for the growth and development of the infant brain, but it's also important for aging adults. And then you have the alpha-glycerol phosphorylcholine, and that boosts acetylcholine, and that's the most important neurotransmitter that you're going to have deficient as you grow older. And then vinpocetin, V-I-N-P-O-C-E-T-I-N-E, that enhances circulation and oxygenation to the brain cells, and that improves your neurological electrical conductivity, and that protects against neuron-destroying excitotoxicity, such as artificial sweeteners, such as coffee, such as cell phones, and being close to a computer, or being close to a microwave, or even smart meters. And I'll be doing later this week an in-depth special on smart meters and why you should not allow them on your home. And then if you look, I'll just take one more. You look at the phosphatidyl grapeseed extract, and that is very good to improving blood vessel tone and elasticity, and it enhances blood circulation, oxygen flow in the brain. And that's what you need. So you see, there's good science behind all the different things we can do to help our brain. But there's one thing as far as most people, they're not eating their cruciferous vegetables, and we should. Simply, we have been conditioned to believe that broccoli and asparagus and Brussels sprouts and the mustard family, and radishes, daikon, that these are not that tasty, and you don't find them on a fast food menu. Now, if you deep fried and battered broccoli and had broccoli bits, then I guess it would be popular. Now, I love broccoli, and I eat it every day, but I also, not only do I eat the cruciferous vegetables, like asparagus, but I also take a compounding powder to make sure I get it every day because I know what it does. And one of the ingredients in the cruciferous vegetables is called I-3-6. I stands for indole, 3 carbinol. And it's one of the best things we could do, and is done in other diets like the Japanese diet. And we can get it in, let's say, on the Americans, those who eat the most legumes, like lentils and soybeans, the most who have the colored vegetables, your red, your green, your purple vegetables, tomatoes, your cruciferous cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower. You have the lowest rate of prostate cancer. The women have the lowest rate of breast cancer and ovarian cancer and brain cancer. On the other end of this discussion is every article I've seen, and just once and for all, to put this in perspective, I have just spent a year by having some scholars, including Dr. Dorothy Smith, collect every article in the scientific literature showing the impact of meat as we consume it on our health from peer-reviewed literature. Hundreds and hundreds of studies. All of them bad. None of them good. So for those who advocate a meat-based diet, dairy-based diet, that's their right, that's their choice, that's your choice to take it, but there's no science supporting you. On the other hand, the science behind, and over 400 studies from Loma Linda University Medical School alone, supporting a vegan, healthy vegan diet, it's all supportive. So that's the amazing thing about a society that wants to know what's good for them, then when told, doesn't change at all because they're tied into their comfort. You want to increase your risk of prostate cancer? Eat red meats. You'll get there. You want to increase your risk of metastatic and advanced cancers? Eat the dairy and meats. You'll get there. So, and for the African American community, they're particularly at risk of these high rates of prostate cancer. And the reason is because the high levels of cooked meat, and like barbecued ribs and fried chicken, and what is historically known as the sole protein foods. Well, there's nothing good about this. It's called heterocyclic amines. And that creates a mutant prostate DNA. And that can lead to cancer. Well, what do we do about it? So to prevent prostate cancer, we have to go on a vegan diet, and drink lots of vegetable juice, and then eat lots of cruciferous vegetables. The more cruciferous vegetables you eat, the better it is, the less cancer you get. That's just what all the studies show. And then along comes this I3C, indole-3-carbinol, and it helps prevent and stop prostate cancer. It's most well known for its hormone-modulating effects. Studies show that indole-3-carbinol changes not only estrogen metabolism, but testosterone and other forms of metabolism. Its hormone-altering action can help protect against hormone mimickers, such as the drugs implanted in animal foods. And it's been confirmed that whether a hormone is the real thing, a drug facsimile or a chemical, the indole-3-carbinol will neutralize it. And that, presumably, includes supplements such as pregnenolone and DHEA, which are converted in the body to hormones. And another way that indole-3-carbinol stops cancer is by keeping carcinogens from damaging the DNA. It helps protect our DNA from free radicals. And it blocks aflatoxin, a mycotoxin that can cause prostate cancer, and also blocks the cancer-causing effects of heterocyclic amines from cooked meat. So it's just a superstar. It gets in there and it can do good for your body, especially if you have a hormone-driven cancer. So let's just say that you eat meat and you drink alcohol. Well, then you got a double negative. And all the more reason that you should be looking at indole-3-carbinol. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you. If you're just tuning in, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us. I'm going to be taking your calls now at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and we're going to speak with Luann Panessi, who reads your emails. I've been traveling and filming virtually every day and haven't had a chance to do that, so she takes it upon herself to do it. Now, these are some short pieces that I thought you'd find interesting. This is from Robert Reich from Op-Ed News, and he said how not to get Big Pharma to change its ways. Quote, there's no good reason why doctors should be allowed to accept any perks at all from companies whose drugs they write prescriptions for. It's an inherent conflict of interest. Codes of ethics that are supposed to limit such gifts obviously don't work. All perks should be banned, and doctors that accept them should be subject to potential loss of their licenses to practice. Earlier this week, the Justice Department announced a $3 billion settlement of criminal and civil charges against pharma giant GlaxoSmithKline, the largest pharmaceutical settlement in history, for improper marketing prescription drugs in the late 90s and 2000s. The charges are deadly serious. Among other things, Glaxo was charged with promoting to kids under 18 an antidepressant approved only for adults, pushing two other antidepressants for unapproved purposes, including remedying sexual dysfunction to further boost sales of prescription drugs, showering doctors with gifts, consulting contracts, speaking fees, even tickets to sporting events. A $3 billion fine may sound like a lot of money, but during these years, Glaxo made $27 billion on these three antidepressants alone. Besides, to the extent the penalty affects Glaxo's profit and its share price, the wrong people will be feeling the financial pain. Most of today's Glaxo shareholders bought into the company after the illegal profits were already built into the price they paid for their shares. Not a single executive has been charged, nor will they, even though some charges against the company are criminal. Glaxo's current CEO came on board after all this happened, so it's nothing going to happen to him. So the only way to get big companies like these to change their behaviors to make the individuals responsible feel the heat. And even more basic issues, why the advertising and marketing of prescription drugs is allowed at all when consumers can't buy them and shouldn't be influencing doctors' decisions anyway. Finally, there's no good reason why doctors should be allowed to accept any perks at all from companies whose drugs they write prescription for. It's an inherent conflict of interest. What do you think about that? Robert Reich is a professor of public policy, University of California, Berkeley. Now, this is an interesting piece also. This is short, too. This is from Peter Goodchild of Countercurrents, and it says, the paradox of rural life. Rural life, meaning living in the country. And it says, all of humanity is now involved in a global collapse, which is happening on two levels. The material, like fossil fuels, metals, and foods, and the economic, unemployment, high prices, debt crisis. Basically, it's the first causing the second, as in ancient Rome, but the causality is complicated, now as it was then. By the year 2020, the only real solution will be to move away from cities, because ultimately that is the only way to prove independence from the cataclysm. This will be a move on the part of the individual person. Collective decisions on the national or even municipal level will be largely impossible because most people are indecisive on such issues. The politicians prefer less embarrassing questions. Escaping from the city will be the ultimate do-it-yourself project. But buying rural property at the moment, at least in the more industrialized countries, involves a bizarre irony. In spite of our ingrained ideas about going back to nature, the reality is that it's very expensive. Thoreau's Walden is a wonderful book, but there's more to country living than growing beans. Elegant country living, to use the term of the glossy magazines, isn't available on demand. Those who most need it to get out of the city are those who have the least money, while those who find it easiest to get out of the city are those who are rich enough to be hauling huge motorboats behind them as they travel. It's the irony, or so it seems to me. One morning I watched such a boat going down the road. The rich can live well in the city because endless goods and services are available with money. They can also live well in the country for exactly the same reason. The non-rich, the majority of the population, cannot live well as well in the city It's the non-rich, therefore, who have the greater needs to escape to the country. But the fact is that the non-rich are, in many ways, locked into the city. For them, the city is expensive, but it is habitable. The countryside is not. Even the city, even if you cannot live in luxury without money, you can at least get by there. You can survive in the city with little money, but you cannot survive in the country with no money. On the other hand, in order to move to the country during these earlier days of collapse, you would need money for the purpose of property, and while the property in the country is not as expensive as in the city, it is still not cheap. Okay, your thoughts on that. So he's saying the poor middle class are stressed. They don't get enough good quality relaxation. They deserve to be in the country, but they can't afford to be there. While the rich, they can live anywhere. And when they do go to the country, they create the same extravagant lifestyle in the country that they do in the city. Yes and no. You go out to Aspen, Colorado. You go to Vail, Colorado. I know a person that is home in Vail, and I warned this person. I knew this couple. I said, you're not paying attention to the economy. This guy worked on Wall Street. He was making a lot of money. He had a $9 million home in Vail and then bought one in Aspen for $7 million. Had a big estate in New Jersey. Now he's broke. So, yes, private jets to fly them here and there, homes. And so anyone living in the Vail-Aspen area, if you were middle class, you couldn't afford it. That was also true of Santa Fe. The Santa Fe, for 20 years, has been a wealthy person's paradise. So the people who do the massage, work in the restaurants, provide the services to the people who want those services. You know, you want Qigong? You want aromatherapy? You want to do yoga? The person who's going to teach it has to live in Albuquerque and drive the hour to Santa Fe because they can't live there anymore. They can't afford it. So, and this has happened all over across the United States. It's now happening in Austin. And it's happened in Taos. But that's not the country. The real country are at least the 34 states where you could live, where there is a quality of life. And who says you have to do it by yourself? I believe that the future is based upon the we principle and not the I, me principle. For the last 40 years, my generation, the baby boomers, who caused all of our problems, including our children, who are nothing but nuts and selfish and stupid, and their children, who aren't even smart enough to realize how stupid they are, because when you go to school today and you're young, the teacher says, well, Jimmy, we want you not to feel bad for being so dumb, so Jimmy, you're going to get an A. And the person who got an A, Bob, you're really smart and you get an A, but Bob, you're going to have an A with a hug. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But hey, that's the way the world is. We're not going to be able to change two whole generations. And the baby boomers are only finding out now when they're about ready to retire. Now their kids are living back with them because that college degree is worth about nothing for most of them. In any case, it was all about material consumption at a level we've never experienced. Greed, selfishness, self-absorption, narcissism, that's what held the day. Now I think it's time for some humility, cooperation instead of competition, working on barter and shared experience. And that gets you into the country. And that is open and viable for the middle class, even the poor class, not just the rich. Because the rich will never share anything with anyone. Everyone else would. Now go to the country and see who's likely to have an organic farm. The rich? No. No, not unless they hired someone to come out and plant their lettuce for them, you know, and then a chef to make sure it's prepared in a gourmet dish for them. No, they wouldn't survive very well if the lights went out. So I'm optimistic about the middle class getting out of the cities in the next, not 10 years, not 8 years. I believe that you're going to be forced out in the next 5 based upon rising sea levels, economic crisis, and social collapse, and possibly even a big solar flare. One other thing, if you didn't love the IRS enough, here's one more reason to think about them. Quote from Roger Johnson, this is based upon this new health care plan. The IRS officials on background tell Fox Business the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on health reform gives the IRS even more powers than previously understood. The IRS now gets to know how a small business's entire payroll, the level of their insurance coverage, and it gets to know the income of not just the primary breadwinner in your house, but your entire family's income in order to assess and collect the mandated tax. Plus, it gets to share your personal info with all sorts of government agencies, insurance companies, employers. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Quote, we expect even more lien and levy powers, the IRS official said. And the IRS army will increase in size. The IRS will now add new agents to hunt down tax cheats. And they're getting $303 million just to build a new system in order to make all this happen. Well, that's great. Create one gigantic worthless bureaucracy. Are there any other but worthless ones to confiscate even more of our money? I'm Gary Nall. We've got a full line of calls. Plus, we have Luann in studio. You can call us at 888-874-4888. And let's say hello to Eric from New Jersey. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Gary. Thank you for everything you're doing. Quick question on the juicing. Is there any specific combinations, or I could just throw in all kinds of veggies and together greens and, you know, cucumbers and, like, everything all together? It doesn't really matter what combo, and just make sure you get, like, two, three or more glasses a day.
No.
And then what do you do with the fiber? Do you actually put it in other smoothies, other recipes? And
all right. The answer is no, you cannot just put everything in, because if you get a predominance of dark green vegetables, like let's say that you had arugula, watercress, and parsley, you would have too much of the acids that come with them, and you would end up getting probably a sick stomach. You'd vomit it out. Like you'd have too much wheatgrass juice. You should always start with 75% of the juice being cucumber, carrot, cucumber, celery, and apple. Then you can add small amounts of the other greens in. That's how I would do it. And there's several things you can do with the fiber. First, you can use it as a vegetable stock to make yourself a soup. And that's always good. Also, if you have birds love the pulp that is ejected. And then you can also use that as compost. And that nourishes the soil. Thank you for your call. Robert from the Bronx. Hi, Robert. Hi, Robert. You're on. Turn off your radio, please. No? Okay, well, you have to turn off the radio when you're on. You got to listen over the telephone. We'll take another call. Let's say hello to Garrett from Philadelphia. Hi, Garrett. You're on.
Greetings. I have a question about stomach cancer. My mother-in-law has stomach cancer. I've heard you speak about the advantages of cabbage juice. I wanted to know about how much cabbage juice should be taken in.
Okay. The cabbage juice I was referring to was for inflammation and also E. pylori helicobacter, which is the bacteria that causes ulcers that can lead to stomach cancer. And I was suggesting three 12-ounce glasses of raw cabbage juice a day. And also cruciferous vegetables, including the indole-3 carbonyl that I mentioned today. 8 servings of cruciferous vegetables a day, and specifically heavy on the broccoli sprouts, heavy on asparagus, and lots of vitamin C with aloe vera. And aloe vera juice about 4 times a day, and with bromelain. Bromelain's a great anti-inflammatory. And if the Wolbe enzymes. So hope that gets you started. But watch the 4.5-hour documentary. Watch it with your mom on preventing and reversing cancer naturally.
Very right. Good. Thank you again, sir.
All the best to you, Jarrett.
All the best to you.
Thank you. Let's go in the studio. Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here from Jimmy. He says, my family has a home in Woodstock, and he goes up there every summer. Every year. And there's always lectures and performances, as it's a substantially an artist community. He said, I've been here in the Woodstock Community Center many times, but I have never seen the size of a crowd and reaction to a speaker as we had to you in my entire life. I was told by regulars it was the largest turnout in the history of that center, and that while some of us sat in 100-plus degree temperatures inside, that there were more people outside. And he said, I have not been at a foot-stomping, shout-out-loud bravado experience like this. It rocked, and we're still talking about it up here. You want to share with us what went on?
I can't comment on, because I'm not familiar with the Woodstock Community Center's past events, but I got up there about a half hour, 45 minutes before the event started. It was last Saturday. And two individuals from the cable system up there invited me. I'd been up there in October and premiered a film, Death by Medicine, and Knock on the Devil's Door. We played two in one night, and it was packed. It was hotter up there than it was in New York City. They were having a particularly brutal heat wave last Saturday. And I mean, it was blistering. Now, Woodstock is a very charming community. It's about 2 hours north of New York, up around Kingston. And it's not large. There's only about 6,000 people live in the immediate area. And lots of laid-back people. It's known as being an artist community. Writers, artists of different backgrounds like to get up there. Small town. I mean, you could walk from one end to the other in about 5 minutes, 10 minutes. There's not a whole lot to it. One natural food restaurant, which I tried some food at, which was okay. Very slow service. But it was edible. Certainly wouldn't be what you'd find in California or in your Upper West Side vegan restaurants. But it's Woodstock. So everyone's kind of... I think one of the reasons you're not going to have the high quality in a lot of places that you would otherwise is because everyone, I think, is high on drugs.
Gary.
I think everyone was stoned in Woodstock.
Is that why they were stomping their feet?
I think it was probably... Yeah. No, they're nice people up there. Great spirit. So when I went to the community center, I saw these people outside, and so I said to the guy, I said, shouldn't we get everyone in? He said, everyone is in. He said, these are the people who can't get in. I thought, whoa. So it was packed to the people standing, and Gerald Salante showed up, and Gerald's a wonderful human being, and Liz and Ryan Beckin came over. There are a lot of well-known people in the art community who came over to say hello. Played the film, The War on Health, Cult of Tyranny of the FDA, and I did a 25-minute talk before the film, and I did about a 45-minute talk after the film. But while the film was going on, I went outside and did a whole lecture for all the people that couldn't get in who were in there, and there was no air conditioner and there was no fans. I'm going to guess it was about 110 inside. So kudos to the people of Woodstock who stuck through that heat to watch the film, stayed for the Q&A afterwards. I gave them all copies of the film. Good group of people. I like the people in Woodstock. It's a beautiful little community. Very charming. So that was Woodstock. And yeah, they were enthusiastic. They were very enthusiastic.
That's great. I also have, I've been getting emails from the people who were at your homestead back in May. And I had the great privilege of interviewing many of the people who wanted to come down and learn about homesteading. And just wonderful feedback coming in. There was a group of homeless people who came back and started doing a community garden and helping others to grow their own gardens based on the information that they learned while they were down at your homestead. And also there were a group of nuns who were kind of doing the same thing. They've created their own gardens, community gardens. And something very interesting that the nuns said, they said, we may be poor, but spiritually we're very, very prosperous. I thought that was very nice. Good feedback on that.
My reasoning for inviting those who have so little is because a lot of people who have so much take everything for granted. There's this almost sense of entitlement. You know, if people have money, they should be invited everywhere. Well, not in my world. In fact, to the contrary, who is most likely to benefit from this information? We forget, what did a person do before they were homeless? What was their role in life? How do they survive now? Are they on the streets? Are they in a shelter at night? I just spoke with some people who were turning in right downstairs from the studio here, is the Duane Reade. They were turning in their, you know, their bottles. They get, I think, a nickel each. And the guy said that in a day he can make enough, sometimes $35, which is enough to get him with one other person into a single-room occupancy place so he can have a bed to sleep in and a shower. And so you talk with them and you realize before you judge these people and before you walk by them without giving a second thought, understanding where they were, because I've seen people with master's degrees who are homeless, living out on the streets. So it is my theory that when you teach a person the basic survival skills and how to grow things, something as simple as sprouts, and then to look in all the communities in the United States that we are not growing things, and we could, where there are people who need to eat, and who better to help them, people who have no food, who have no regular meal. So if I have a choice of inviting someone who, yeah, they're going to have a breakfast in the morning, they got a refrigerator, they can go to a health food store, a farmer's market, or a regular market, and buy what they want, versus a person wakes up in the morning and they don't have any of that. So you give them the tools, and then they go back, and they do that for themselves, and they start helping other people. Where's the greater good come from? And I just think it's people's arrogance and hubris where they take everything for granted, and they look down upon people who are not in their same economic position. At a time when we have so many people suffering, I don't believe anybody should be looking down at anyone else. And think of the nuns. Now, whether you agree upon the rituals and their beliefs is irrelevant. It's their right. That's why I believe that there are three things you really don't talk to people about and try to change their mind. There's sex, politics, and religion. Because rarely you're going to change anyone's mind. Or you're going to just confront them and get into an argument. But if a person decides that something within their beliefs allow them to connect with you and to grow, fine. So if nuns start realizing that one of the things they can do honoring their own, you know, religious vows is to help others who are poor, which they do, and if they can grow food rather than a lot of the donated canned food they get, which is frequently out of date or really not healthy. So if you could grow food organically, if you had the grounds to do it and you could grow food and give it, you know, whatever it is, to a homeless person in maybe a soup kitchen, isn't that a better good? And virtually all the nuns I've spoken to are very conscientious about their health. They're very educated. I have nuns listening to the show since I've been on the radio. A whole group upstate, I sent them free vitamins. They didn't ask for them, but they couldn't afford them. And because, hey, if they're willing to make a sacrifice and to help other people, then I believe that, you know, that's worthy of support. So I believe that we could have an entire shift, a sea change in the United States if religious leaders of all religions got their congregations healthy. Imagine what it would be. Even if they didn't take to the streets to protest the wars or to protest the corruption within our economic and religious and other systems, if they just cared enough about their own congregants and say, we have a lot of people in this congregation or this synagogue or this mosque who have high blood pressure, who have cancer, think of the good they'd be doing. In fact, the other day, I walked into the health food store to get a juice, and who should I see but Dr. Ibrahim Malik. Do you know Ibrahim Malik? No? Yes? All right, he is one of the leading imams in the entire part of the United States. He's Harvard-educated, PhD, taught. I've known him. He's been a friend of mine since I was in New York City. Great guy. Athletic. I think he is 86. And one of the things he does, every day he does his walk, does his five-mile walk, does his sit-ups, and then he gets his juices. He's very strict about his diet, and that's why he's so healthy at his age. But he teaches what he knows about health to other people. So all the people that he advises on spiritual issues, he also talks about health issues. Now, he's one person. He's one person who has a very large following, and think of the lives he's saved because of his own personal experience. Well, I think that could be a gigantic health revolution in the United States. if religious leaders in churches, synagogues, and mosques began to have whole health dynamic communities. Now, I was asked, would I go up to Harlem? I was just over in Brooklyn lecturing to a whole group of Caribbean churches who got together. We're going to do the same thing up in Harlem. They're getting a bunch of churches together. So there'll be thousands of people who will be all on a health protocol, and I'm going to do that in the near future.
That's great. We also had a Gary Null sighting at the Lincoln Center Movie Theater on Friday. Someone said that they saw you watching the documentary, The Queen of Versailles. And he asked, what did you think? And he asked, what do you feel is the relevance to our lives?
Yes, I did walk down to Lincoln Theater, Lincoln Center Theater, to watch this new documentary. It's an extraordinarily depressing documentary. It's a real downer. Very briefly, it shows a couple, and it's focused almost exclusively upon this couple. He, about, I think he's 74 years old. She is in her 40s, and she was a Florida beauty queen, and he has the largest timeshare resorts in the world. I think he has 28 of them or something like that. And his biggest one was this billion-dollar gigantic hotel in Las Vegas. So at the beginning of the film, it shows them in their 27,000-square-foot house, but it's not big enough, so they're now building a separate house that is the largest house in America, the largest family house in America. It's 90,000 square feet. And it's under construction when she goes in to show you, oh, this is my husband's closet. It's a little closet, a little walk-in, like 6 foot by 6 foot. Then her closet's like 2,000 square feet. And then she shows you her shoes. Well, these are 12,000, these are 20,000, these are like 2,000 pairs of shoes. And then after it shows you the kids, she has 7 kids, and then one was one of his children from a previous marriage. And he's talking about how important he is, and he got George Bush elected, but he can't tell you how because it could be illegal. And you're looking, thinking, I hope there's something else in this film, because this is just showing the worst of human nature. They both come across, the woman comes across as the most vacuous, superficial, self-absorbed, selfish human being imaginable. She even makes some of these idiots on the, you know, housewives of wherever look kind by comparison. And the husband is just one brooding, aggressive, maniacal business power person, all about power. And then you get a revealing moment where his son, who works for him, he says, my father was never warm. My father and I never had a father-son relationship. I can never remember once my father ever saying a kind thing to me. He says, I'm an employee of my father. That's all we share. Nothing else. When we get together, it's only about business. Nothing else. That's revealing. The woman, they show you a house where the dogs are not house trained. So everywhere in the house, there's dog crap. Everywhere. And they have 28 people that work there just cleaning up, but the place is just a pigsty. It's ugly, and it's dirty, and it's tacky, showing you can have money and no taste. And boy, this is what I call checkbook aestheticism, where someone was able to write someone a check to go do something for them, but they didn't look to see how are you doing this. And so then the financial crisis came, and people, the banks stopped giving all that cheap money. And then the second part of the story is how they're coping when his empire is being foreclosed on. And he doesn't want to give it up. But he's told, if you give up this, give the bank this big billion-dollar, you know, hotel in Las Vegas, they'll give you all the money you want, so you can keep your houses and you keep your businesses. He doesn't want to do it. And then you think, why not? Because of his ego. That's all this guy's got. And then you start to see this family. They're utterly disconnected. Like the children, you see the kid, the little spoiled brat, just a brat of a teenage daughter, lets her lizard die. You see this big lizard just dead because she didn't want to feed him, didn't water him. And then you see the fish dead. And you see these, and then the kid says something to the effect of, oh, okay, so now I guess I'm a bad person. Yeah, you are, but not in that strange world, that psychopathological world of never allowing your children to be responsible and teaching many lessons about manners, morals, ethics, responsibility. They're just spoiled rotten. So you come out of the theater and you see that just the implosion where they actually have to go to Walmart. But when she goes to Walmart, she buys like 4 truckloads of crap. And then it shows you going into the garage and it's just stuffed to the brims with bicycles and everything that these kids don't use and don't care about. The message to me was the pathology of power. That we are so enamored with power that we sell our souls to get it. That if you're not rich, you want to live like a rich person, even if it creates credit card debt. If you buy things you know you're not going to be able to pay for, and that was one of the things of the liar loans. People making $30,000 a year and buying a $400,000 house, knowing full well they couldn't afford it. Or people buying 3 cars instead of one. People sending their kids to private universities when a public education would have been fine, save them money. Why? Because we're not happy with who we are. We live through this distorted image of self. So when we see the people in our society who we think are doing well, look what they have, look at their house, their car, look what their kids have. And then now the kid says, well, I want the same thing. The kids are tuned into that selfish, narcissistic expression that everything is about how they feel. There's no what, only why. Why didn't you buy me something? Instead of, what should I be doing with my life? Is there something in this house I can do to help, you know, this house be a better house? What can we do to spend more quality time together? Instead of, why didn't you pay for this? And why am I not going there? And why am I? And so this breeds this contempt for responsibility and maturity. And so this is one of those rare films, and I commend the filmmaker for doing it, of showing you the reality of the super rich. Because it's entirely possible that this family is going to be dirt poor with no friends and nothing backstopping their slide. Would these kids survive? Not at all. And they'll hate their parents because the parents didn't keep giving them everything to keep them spoiled. There's no way that this family is going to do anything, in my opinion, except disintegrate. But I'll bet that is typical of probably 95% of all wealthy families in the United States. They're held together by what they share in their materialistic or power values. The conversations are about their deals and businesses and what they need and what they want, not what they care about in the other human being. The lack of empathy, the lack of compassion, the lack of love, the lack of any authentic emotions is palpable right across the spectrum. And that's why people can go to work tomorrow, Luann, and make deals that cause other people to suffer. They can force up the price of water or oil or gas or food without thinking, what if someone can't eat the same because they can't afford the food? What if someone can't heat? What if they can't drive the same distance because they don't care? They come from a selfish culture. The kids going on Wall Street don't give a damn about anyone. The entire culture of Wall Street, some 600,000 people on Wall Street and 6 million around the country in financial services, only care about themselves. And if you went into their lives, you would see that what they talk about on their dates, what they talk about when they're with their friends, is materialism or preoccupation with how they feel. Nothing about what they do that can contribute to a better world or other people. They just don't do it. It would be the exception. Now, I'm sure there are exceptions, but the rule is, we now have a chance through this film to see how bad human nature is, how removed from reality human nature is, how lacking in substance and authenticity human nature is when we get close enough to it to see it for what it is. And I guess to a lesser extent, you see this in all these reality shows. You think, how could someone dress that ugly? How could they talk that trashy? How could they be that vulgar? How could they be that pushy? Simple. Because that's who they are.
Worse yet, why would people watch that?
Because it reflects something that they can associate with. Mm. People who have a life will not watch it. people who love life in an authentic way would never watch these type of programs. They would not. People who have no excitement in their life will watch an Ultimate Sports or the super challenging, you know, Daredevils. But remember, once you go beyond a certain step in any choice you make, it's all downhill. Once you see the Ultimate Fighters on television beating each other to a pulp, that won't do it anymore. Once you see someone like Lady Gaga, who's a complete artificial creation of our culture, she will burn out for no other reason than someone else will do something more extreme than her of grabbing attention. And it doesn't matter how little talent they have and zero charisma or ethics. It's what they're willing to do to entertain us while we die a slow death from the metastasis of social dysfunction. This is all bread and circus. Anyone who's living an authentic life would never turn on these television shows, would never be associated with these people. But that's why they exist. And that's why they're popular. But anyone I know who actually has a life never would waste their time on this stuff. But this film gave me an idea. I think I'm going to do a documentary now showing the pathology of power of all the titans who have failed in the last 30 years, like Michael Milken, Ivan Votsky. The people have gone to prison, people have gone bankrupt, but at one time they were the top people in their field, and they were praised, and no one ever wanted to get close enough to see how'd you make your money, did others suffer so you could make that money, and why was it when you had all that money and all that power and all that fame, why did you do something illegal? Why couldn't you get out of being greedy? Because it doesn't matter. The money is not what's important. The power is what they need. They're going for power. It used to be celebrities had power. Today, the celebrities don't have the power. Today, those who have the most possessions have the power. And there's never enough for them to be happy in their own skins. So therefore, they're always running towards power and away from insecurity. And fear of not having security keeps them going to where if you set them at a table with 6,000 dishes in front of them, they would try eating from all of them. That is the insatiable appetite of someone who's insecure. And look at it in a more simpler way. And by the way, there's about 500 people in our society, and no one pays attention to their stories, what lesson we could learn, who've all gotten everything and failed and crashed out. And how they get appointed to boards like the Museum of Natural History, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Museum of Modern Art, and Channel 13, PBS. How do all these real bad people who lack ethics, how do they get appointed there? It's the money. Because the money is perceived as power. And therefore they can bring something to that institution. It's not about ethics, because if we really wanted ethical people, we'd go out and find ethical, kind people. And that doesn't help the bottom line of these nonprofits, nor does it help the bottom line of corporate America. Look at it at this level. Have you ever noticed people who need love so much that no matter what they're given, it's never enough? That's just part of that insecurity. Insecurity will manifest in different ways. For some people, it's constant craving, constant demand for love and attention. For others, if they have the opportunity, it's success. For others, it's attention, needing to be in the public eye until they rub it raw. We're out of time. Thank you, Luann.
Okay.
I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank all of you for listening. Wish you a great day. Stay tuned for Michael Rupert Show right here on the Progressive Radio Network.